All right, wake up, sleeper. Rise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you. J.D. Walt here with another one of our conversations. And today we have Amy Orr Ewing. Did I say that right?
You did. Well done. I sensed a slight hesitation there, but
yes,
you smashed it. That was perfect.
I sometimes have dyslexed it in my mind, and I'll say Amy Ewing Orr. It's Amy Orr Ewing.
Exactly. Well
so
done.
So thankful. Well, Amy is going to be one of our preachers at New Room Conference this fall, and she's going to be leading a pre-conference. She is a lot of different things. I'm just going to let her kind of tell you some of that, and we're going to have a conversation about the things that maybe some of the edges and horizons of what she's doing right now. It's very significant. It's very timely. And so, Amy, why don't you tell us, like, where you are and what you're up to, what you're doing.
Thank you. Well, I'm at the moment right now, I'm in the UK, I'm at home, and I live about halfway between London and Oxford, if you know the sort of geography of Britain. I am a preacher, a public theologian, I have a sort of background in Christian apologetics. So for the last nearly 30 years, I've been preaching and doing kind of public events about the Christian faith in contexts where people don't have faith, and answering questions and seeing people come to know Jesus. I've written a few books, things like Why Trust the Bible? Where is God in all the suffering? My most recent book is Forgiveness, Reclaiming Its Power in a Culture of Outrage and Fear. And I just have a real heart to see the kingdom come and to use the voice that God has given me and the opportunities he's given me to proclaim that truth and see the Spirit move. So that's a little bit about me. Do you want to hear about my family as well?
Please.
I don't know.
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm married to a wonderful man. We have been married we're coming up to our 29th wedding anniversary. Nearly got that wrong. 29th wedding anniversary. And he is called Frog. That is his nickname, but everyone knows him as that. He's been a pastor and a sort of missional entrepreneur. And we have had the joy of spending nearly three decades of married life together and serving Jesus. We have three sons who are also wonderful, twins who are 20 and a 17-year-old.
Okay, so you're still in the thick of it there.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you're in the United States a fair amount, and
absolutely, yeah.
Tell us first, just what is a public theologian? I like that nomenclature.
Yeah. So, the idea of public theology is that we kind of study deeply. So, you know, my doctoral work was at Oxford, and I have, you know, visiting lectureships at different universities from Aberdeen to Wheaton College. So there's a sort of scholarship there, but the heart is about connection, both in the public square, like demonstrating, showing persuasively that the Christian faith is actually true and deserves a hearing, you know, in the public square. But also public theology, I think, is about engaging people in every walk of life with the depth of the Christian gospel. So hopefully in a way that they feel is meaningful, that answers questions that resonate with them, and that can actually stand up to their scrutiny and questions as well. Yeah.
And you've spoken in Parliament, you've spoken to the Senate in the United States, to be a public theologian, you are a preacher, but to carry that kind of moniker gets you into places to witness, essentially.
Yeah, it's interesting that I think the description sort of came after the invitation. So I might have, you know, had the opportunity to speak to George W. Bush's West Wing White House at the White House, or, you know, go into Goldman Sachs Bank and speak there. But you're speaking about Jesus, and you're speaking about the Christian faith, and then answering people's questions, but doing it in a public setting. And so I just felt like that phrase public theologian kind of makes sense of that. But more recently, then, I have found that that description feels accessible to people who are inviting me. So I'm not a priest or a pastor. I'm someone who's really thinking about these things, and I do preach and proclaim in churches and conferences as well. But the primary heart is that public witness to the faith.
So, I mean, there's so many things I'd like to talk to you about. I mean, I would love it. I'm just trying to think, okay, how can I not be just self-indulgent and talk about the things I want to talk about with you, and talk about things that I know will be encouraging and helpful to other people. You talk about awakening. I've heard you talk about awakening and the holiness of God. Give us a little bit on that here. And I'm just curious also in this, I'm always interested to know, like, what texts are you presently kind of camped out in, where you're just exploring, you're digging, you're trying to understand things from, Revelation.
Yeah, thank you. Well, can I start with the first one and land in the text?
Yeah.
I love that word awakening. If you look at the sort of history of revival and the moves of God that have happened in history, one of the characteristics of a spiritual awakening in a culture or a language group is that the holiness of God becomes evident and becomes an experienced reality, both to people who have previously had no faith, but also critically actually in the church. It's like outsiders awaken to the majesty and even actually the judgment of a just and good God and realize I need forgiveness, I need the Savior. And that's how, you know, people come to faith. But in the church, you also see that awakening coming hand in hand with the holiness of God being revealed, which often looks like actually sin being uncovered. I experienced this in an organization that I had, you know, been part of for a long time, where the founder was found to be in kind of grievous, egregious sin and actually abuse of women. And, you know, when you're going through all of the trauma that involves, untangling what on earth is going on, and, you know, all the kind of relational fallout and loss of job, loss of income, all that kind of thing, one of the things I really felt the Lord say to me is that this is what happens when God's holiness and an awakening to who he is actually happens in the church. So all the crises that we've seen and the sin and dysfunction that has been uncovered in our systems is actually a part of an awakening to God. It's not the opposite of it. This is God showing up. And we're sort of dealing with that sin and moral wrongdoing. And so learning to embrace that and desire the holiness of God as something good and beautiful and true and powerful. And then in the wider culture, one of the things I think is really interesting, if you look at kind of missiology and, you know, missional practice in the last 30 years, until about, well, probably still, this is what we're thinking, but till about 2-3 years ago, the whole sort of seeker sensitive model was like, let's lower the bar as low as possible, make it as easy as possible for people to, you know, encounter the faith and, you know, let's not be legalistic, let's kind of make everything very comfortable and not focus on any of the bits of the gospel that might be challenging, whether that's around sexuality or the uniqueness of Christ. You know, let's let people sort of get there eventually, but don't ever lead with that. And it struck me that one of the things God is doing in the awakening we're seeing in the West is that public intellectuals who'd previously been atheists are awakening to the awesomeness of God. So he's not a sort of easy come, easy go Jesus. You know, if you read Tom Holland's Dominion, or if you look at, you know, women like Jordan Peterson and his kind of challenge about the resurrection and the sort of
David Brooks.
Yes, this is about the awesomeness of God. I actually stood in the Hagia Sophia last summer. I was in Turkey for a conference. The Hagia Sophia is the sort of earliest surviving church of Constantinople. It's now, you know, obviously Istanbul, and it's now a mosque. But the image of Christ at the center, which is this kind of earliest image of the Eastern Church of Jesus, and it is Christ on the throne in total authority. It's called Christ Pantocrator. It's Jesus as the cosmic Lord of all creation. God is literally awesome. Mm-hmm. And it's like, that's an awakening to the holiness and power of Jesus. And that's what we're seeing young men in Gen Z and all these young people in Gen Z coming to faith, not through some sort of lowering the bar, easy sort of pizza party approach, but actually meet the living God who shakes you to your core and to your knees and who is worth following. Interesting that you mentioned Jordan Peterson. So before this sort of awakening amongst Gen Z was really, I think, visible in the church, we were seeing stirrings of it in the culture through people like Jordan Peterson. And I remember my then 14-year-old boys and their sort of school friends who wouldn't have grown up in families that have faith at all were all listening to Jordan Peterson. And I remember asking two of these, so young adolescent males with no Christian background whatsoever. And these are not sort of, you know, bookish, nerdy boys. They're all very athletic. They would never willingly read a book, is the way I put it. But they're listening to, you know, over an hour of Jordan Peterson regularly, like taking them deep. And I remember saying to them, what is it that you like about him? And they said, it's two things. Firstly, we like that he doesn't give a bleep about what other people think about him. He knows what he believes is true, and he's willing to sort of pay a cost for that, because obviously he was in the process of being cancelled left, right and centre. And they said, we love that he calls us to do hard things. So this is like the comfort drenched affluent Western adolescent male who's been given everything and is longing to be called for a cause and is longing to be called to come and die, like to take up a cross. I said, give me some examples. What do you like? What do you mean by hard things? And they said, the two examples they gave me, we love that he says to young men, don't be promiscuous. Find a woman that's worth it, settle down, get married and actually have a family. I couldn't believe this is 14-year-old boys. And then they said, we love that he tells us to clean our room. I was like, doesn't your mum say that? they said, well, yeah, our mum does say it, but it kind of lands differently when Jordan Peterson says it. It's like, your life has purpose. You want to be called to, you know, lean into cost. This is extraordinary.
Yeah.
So to me, that speaks of a longing for the holiness of God in the culture.
Well, yeah.
And a high calling. Yeah.
I think what people, probably particularly the young, are saying is, they're saying, don't lower the bar but can you move the barriers?
Mm.
And I think that's what the church has unwittingly and inadvertently done is they have thought people wanted the bar lowered. And instead, what people have wanted is just move the barriers out of the way. Mm. What's obscuring this? And we've just, you know, cliches. We traffic the image of made in the image of God has become cliche. I wonder, what do you think that means, that we're made in the image of God?
Well, that sort of links really profoundly, I think, though, to the next thing that sort of happened. So on the one hand, now we're in this moment of awakening and waking to the holiness of God. But I think what preceded that, and it's still hanging around on, you know, secular Ivy League type campuses, was this sort of rise of rage and outrage and identity politics, you know, and all the kind of divisions and fracture.
It was power, and power, then, power.
Yeah. So obviously Foucault and power but the way that power is exercised and derived within the identity politics kind of pseudo-Marxist way of seeing the world is actually through grievance and victimhood. So you need intersectional layers of injustice on which to base your identity, whether that's, you know, you're gay, so you've experienced homophobia, or you're a person of colour, so you've experienced racism, or you're a woman, so you've experienced sexism, or you have a disability, you've experienced ableism, or, you know, anything else in between, socioeconomic kind of reasons, all of which are genuine injustice experiences, of course. But this movement says you derive your identity from that injustice, and the power in the moment is exercised through grievance and then, you know, deployed through rage. But what I experienced, you know, as an apologist, as a public theologian going onto these campuses, sometimes being mobbed by, you know, the sort of campaigning groups, the decolonized people, all of, you know, everything that we've seen, because obviously they would see the Christian faith as patriarchal and responsible for colonization, all of that. What I would experience is this visceral rage about harm and abuse done to people. And as I was in the midst of that, this is maybe 7-8 years ago, trying to figure out, how do you preach the gospel in this context? And actually, it was the image of God that turned out to be key, because I was able to say, look, your view of the world, because they're all materialists, they all believe there's no God. And, you know, that means that all we are as human beings is just biochemistry. You're just a basket of atoms. So if you believe what it means to be human is to be a basket of atoms, why are you so angry about what one basket of atoms has done to another? Why are you so angry about what baskets of atoms did to other baskets of atoms 200 years ago? Your worldview can't account for your rage, but I think mine can. So I'm like, I think if it is true that a person is made in the image of God, and that your life has a transcendent source, but also transcendent meaning, which is given to you by your creator, then you would have a way of knowing that and feeling that to be true, whether you believed in that God or not. It would still actually be true.
It's ontology.
Yeah. So the rage we were seeing in the culture, and, you know, this deep sense of visceral pushback against injustice, is actually pointing towards the image of God, not away from God. And that then brings us to, you know, of course, that question of what it means to be human, and how we then connect the holiness of God with the fallenness, the suffering of the world. And that's where only Jesus is the answer.
And he is the image of the invisible God.
Yeah.
The firstborn.
Yeah.
Overall, that text alone
So beautiful, so powerful.
Unbelievable. I mean, and where does it go? In him,
all things hold together.
And he is the head of the body, the church, the firstborn. Yeah. He's the firstborn over all creation. He's the firstborn from among the dead.
In creation, yeah.
For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him.
Yeah. So I totally agree with you. I really feel like high Christology, back to that image of Christ Pantocrator that captivated the early Eastern church. It's like we're done with the convenient Jesus, who is an add-on to the American dream or its British equivalent, the Jesus who is sort of co-opted into our marketing schemes, or, you know, the Jesus that is just weaponized by a corrupt institution to, you know, that's why people have deconstructed their faith. I mean, that's a whole nother conversation.
It needed to be deconstructed, didn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Some of it. Yeah. But the time now is like God in an awakening. God is showing up as God, as actually God. You know, Freud's idea of God as wish fulfillment, you know, this idea that human beings have projected a God in our minds as a sort of, you know, projection of our minds because we want there to be a heavenly father figure. It's a comfort blanket. And so we've just made him up, but he's not actually there. That idea of God as a wish fulfillment, God as an idol that we've created, I think that's been totally shaken in the church. And awakening is when God shows up as God by the power of the Holy Spirit. His presence falls, his holiness is revealed, his awesomeness is revealed. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, golly, where do you go? I think a lot about, Amy, the difference between self-improvement and transformation. And I think I just came up this morning. I came up with a word I've never thought of before. I'm like, and it's self-ianity. Self-ianity is contrasted with Christianity. And how what we have really largely adopted, at least in my own context and background, is what we call Christianity is a self-improvement paradigm in Jesus' name. And this little Jesus sprinkled over, try harder to do better, to be more, and he'll help you, and he'll give you the abundant life. He wants to give you all of, you know, make all your dreams come true. And transformation, which it's that word that you see on the top of the Mount of Transfiguration, metamorpho-o-o. I was looking at this text, and I'd always thought of that as just sort of an anomalous encounter, a one-off, but it's a revelation of the holiness of God in Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
And then I started looking for that word, metamorpho-o, and I found it in two places, Romans 12, verse 2. Do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but metamorpho-o. It's the same word. Be transformed. It's transcendent formation. And then I found it again in 2 Corinthians 3:18, I think, where he says, and we who with unveiled faces, all beholding the glory of the Lord, are metamorpho-o, being transformed into the same image from one degree of glory
to another.
To another. And I think I grew up believing Christianity was the good to great program. And I'm like, It's the death to life movement. It's the light, darkness to light, right? The chaos to new creation.
So good. Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
But the image of God, I don't think we understand. And this is when I work with young people. We've talked about, well, who are you? Well, that whose are you? I'm like, what are you? What is a human being? Right? What is the image of God? And what does sin do to the image of God? How can we help people understand that from beyond just morality?
Yeah. And actually, in a way, morality is just sort of revealing, like the law reveals the sin and dysfunction, doesn't it? It can't transform us. It's only the power of Christ through the power of the cross through which we can actually be transformed.
Be transformed, yeah, to receive it, yeah, right?
Yeah. And it's something that, of course, is something we receive and is imparted to us, but it's also something that is ongoing. It's interesting to me that there is, of course, that once for all, you know, we're born again and there's that beginning point, but there's an expectation in the Christian life of actual growth and visible transformation. I love that image of the fruit of the Spirit, because fruit, you know, it's not just there all the time, hanging there. There are different processes with a fruit tree. You know, there's winter where things are pruned and cut back, and then, you know, it's like there's a bud, and then some blossom, and then a small bit of visible fruit, and then it grows into that tasty, delicious fruit. There's a process there. And the Lord, by his Spirit, over days and months and years, and often in community, is where we're formed in his likeness, you know, and that's
where
that transformation
from,
happens. Yes, yeah, that germination happens.
That's,
yeah,
that's the seeds come from the fruit. It's a self-contained process that,
yeah,
it's the supernatural is being revealed through the natural. Of fruit. That's good. I wonder if you would talk a little bit. Your most recent book is on forgiveness. Mm-hmm. And how did you come to that? What does forgiveness mean in the base, in the essence? Mm-hmm. And yeah, why does it so, just talk about that horizon of your,
yeah,
exploration.
Thank you. Yeah. So I came to it because I was very much working in this kind of context of cancel culture and, you know, this idea that if someone puts a foot wrong, and we have this very much in the UK, if you kind of crossed a line in a way that the culture deemed to be unforgivable, whether that was over an issue of sexuality or, yeah, some kind of aspect of your Christian belief, or it could be really be anything, you know, whether it's the trans question or whatever, cancel culture deemed that you have to die. Essentially, you die a professional death. You have to lose your job. You have to die a social death. You have to be shamed publicly, flogged and shamed, and you have to be cut off from the rest of us, and you're sort of, you're left alone, and there's no redemption, there's no, like, you can't apologize, you can't, you know, sort of put things right. And so I began to think about what was bubbling under that, this sort of concern for justice, and I've already talked about how I think that even that concern for justice can only really be accounted for if we actually value what a human being is, made in the image of God. But also bubbling under it was this idea that, and I came across this a lot, and this did sort of overlap with some of the scandals that we were seeing in the church, but it was this idea that non-Christians who were practicing cancel culture cared about harm and injustice and sin, crucially, more than the church did. And they saw forgiveness as basically a minimizing of harm. And I began to dig into that a bit, both in, you know, public Q&As and conversation, but also in my research, and realized that outside the Christian faith, definition of forgiveness is basically a bit like Elsa in Frozen, that you let it go. So you just release your bitterness and pain to the universe. But what that basically requires of you is it requires to say the harm that happened doesn't hurt anymore, wasn't wrong, or doesn't matter. Now, when you think about sexual abuse, or you think about rape or domestic violence, or you think about modern day slavery, to require someone to say it doesn't hurt anymore, it doesn't matter, or it wasn't wrong, it's actually egregious. Forgiveness is harmful. And that's where some in the culture would land. So here's the thing. I began to ask the question, and when I spoke in the UK Parliament for our prayer breakfast there, and, you know, all these politicians are there, I had 19 minutes and I sort of developed that theme. Could there be such a thing? Is there such a thing as forgiveness that doesn't minimize harm and moral wrongdoing? Could there be a way to have the grace and redemption we all actually long for without requiring us to say that egregious injustice doesn't really matter that much, just let it go, Elsa? And I think that it is only in the Christian faith that this is even conceptually possible, let alone actually true. Like, conceptually, whatever solved this problem, the massive problem of injustice and the scale of harm and moral wrongdoing, would have to be of a cosmic scale. It couldn't be something, you know, like small and ineffectual. So it would have to be a cosmic solution, an intervention from outside the material world. And then I make the argument, that's what the Christian faith says forgiveness is. It would require a cosmic level intervention, a sacrifice that actually upholds the value of the person who's been harmed and the scale of harm at like a transcendent level. That's actually what sin is. And that the answering of that is the cosmic intervention, is the death of the Son of God in history. This is the crucifixion of Jesus of Nazareth is that. So it's like two apologetic things. One, conceivably, this could only be possible if it was something with a cosmic scale. And two, that happened in history. A cosmic event happened in history. And I just found like such joy in... Yeah. Like reclaiming, if you like, the power of the cross. Like, we have made the cross far too small. Mm. Like, unbelievers think what we think the cross is this sort of unfortunate death of a very nice individual, you know, that has some kind of moral example entailed.
It's the hero.
And that is not what the cross is about. There's this cosmic substitution, this sacrifice that happens. And so, back to your question about what forgiveness is, you know, as far as Christian forgiveness is concerned, when I as a Christian forgive someone, I am receiving a power outside of myself that was actually enacted historically through this cosmic event. And through that power from outside of myself, I step into this flow of grace and forgiveness. And I say to God, I trust in a divine solution to this harm that has happened to me. Mm. And my understanding is that this will be enacted in one of two ways. The harm and moral wrongdoing will either be dealt with through the substitutionary atonement of Christ on the cross in history, or it will still actually be paid for because we will all stand before the judgment seat of a holy God. And because I've been made in the image of God and you've been made in the image of God, when harm occurs to against us or God's creation or towards God himself, that has a massive scale and that requires a divine judgment. And so when I forgive, I give up the impetus on me to bring about retribution. I don't live in the power of grievance or bitterness about what has occurred. I live with a posture of trust in the justice of God, either through the cross if someone repents, or ultimately at the judgment seat of Christ. And that releases to me the most unbelievable peace, because I'm now no longer required to get vengeance for what happened. I can forgive and live in this incredible freedom and release. And all the psychological and actually medical literature shows that when we forgive someone who's harmed us, the health benefits, it impacts heart disease, diabetes, it impacts the length of your life, it impacts like the neuroplasticity of your brain. It is so powerful, you know. It has real world consequences, you know, like physical world consequences, as well as real eternal consequences. So sorry, that's a really long answer, but this is
so
something.
Good. It's like I'm hearing in the background, not in the background, in the foreground of all you're saying, God made him who knew no sin to be sin for us.
Yeah.
So that we might become the righteousness of God. And that what you're talking about there is righteousness as a all-comprehensive wellness. Right?
Absolutely. And it, and having an impact eternally, but also an impact on our bodies, on our relationships. I believe it has an impact on nations. So in the book, I look at the difference even between nationalism and patriotism. And I think the critical difference between love of country, patriotism, and nationalism, which is a kind of domineering aggression and forceful imposition of the superiority of my nation over yours and the scapegoating of foreigners or outsiders. The crucial difference is the possibility of being forgiven. Because a patriot can say, I love my country, but I can love your country too. But I love my country because God orders nations. But I can also be honest that not everything is perfect about my country. There are things in our history where we need forgiveness. There are things where we need to make amends. You know, there are things that are not perfect about how we've conducted ourselves historically, you know, that don't cohere with God's word and his law. And forgiveness is what makes the critical, crucial difference, and then the possibility of redemption.
Yeah,
so I think this has literal international implications.
It does. Forgiveness is essentially saying, I'm not going to pay you back for what you did.
There will be a divine reckoning. There will be a payment, but I'm not extracting it from you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Kali, our time is out. I would love it. I mean, I feel like we need about 3 hours. We can truly do a long form. There's so much I'd love to just delve into here. But I want to thank you for your work, for your faith and your faithfulness to stay with it. And it's very important. It's critical work, and I'm sure it's lonely work. I know that. But thank you that you're coming to the New Room conference.
I'm so looking forward to that. Thank you for having me. Can't wait.
It's going to be, we always have a scholar or two who helps speak into this, and you know, certainly you're more than that, but you are that. And we appreciate all of that work that you've done. So anyway, we have to end. You've got probably another one of these next.
I've got a meeting next, but
thank you so much for your time. And everybody, just want to say we're going to put a variety of links. We'll put links to her, to Amy's book, the latest book, and other books, to some of the recent sermons that she has given and talks. And thanks for joining us for this conversation. And we'll see you on the field, team.
Can't wait.